Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A reminder that we are Zooming this show on Wednesday morning, so if something should happen Wednesday night, we'll be discussing it on Friday. You know what we do. We do it every single day. We have been sharing with you the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I knew the minute he spoke truth to power that I needed to hold on to that. I didn't realize that they would do basically a perp walk out of the White House. He would eventually leave. I know that I want his voice ringing in your ear when you exercise the franchise, whether it's vote by mail, whether it's absentee balloting, whether it's in-person balloting, whatever happens, you must vote and hold on to the voice of this incredible patriot as you exercise that vote. So now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, during the impeachment hearings of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
We are on KPFT in Houston, Texas. We hang out with Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quorum Report. And because of Scott and because of KPFT, I have learned so damn much about Texas. It is like unbelievable. And there are a couple of newspapers or places I go to sort of seek information. I go to the Texas Monthly, I go to the Texas Observer, I go to the Dallas Morning News, I go to the Houston Chronicle. I see an article, The Long Tale of Voter Suppression. As the growing number of Black and Latinx voters threaten the GOP stranglehold on power. How do I say this? This is not a Texas-specific story, because in some ways, this story of voter suppression is a story of the last maybe 15 or 20 years that the Republican Party has basically said, they don't really embrace democracy. They want to pick their voters, and they know exactly who they want to encourage to vote and who they want to suppress. Joining us right now is the author of this very comprehensive piece of what's been going on in Texas, and his name is Michael Barajas, and he wrote a piece that was entitled The Long Tale of Voter Suppression. As the growing number of Black and Latinx voters threatens the GOP stranglehold in power, attempts to limit safe voting options during the pandemic reveal a deeper sickness in Texas politics. So let me welcome Michael to the program. Texas college student flies home from California to cast his ballot as voter turnout surges. And the 23-year-old says, I spent $400. I am going to make sure that my vote counts. And in an interesting way, between the voter suppression that's been encouraged by the governor, that's been encouraged by the Republicans in control of the legislature and Donald Trump, in some ways, they're like my children. The more you tell me no, the more I'm going to get to yes. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing here, that this wall that they're trying to build around their vote and suppress the others' vote has really created an incredible emotional impetus for people to say, no, you're not going to defeat me. I am going to cast that vote. So welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I like that angsty sort of child analogy. I think that's kind of appropriate for the situation.
I have two daughters that have been doing this for my whole life. So trust me, I'm a walking example. You give us a history lesson. And I think that's really important because people think the idea of voter suppression is just a today story or a 5-year story or a 10-year story. And I think what we have to sort of come to Jesus on is that this has been a long, long embrace of making a decision that if you were white, you are privileged, you are on the bench, and you don't want to share that bench, especially when it comes to power and governing. What I would love to have you do is sort of do that sort of history lesson for us, because I think it's important for us to understand how we got here. And this is not unique. It is a pattern in practice.
I've been covering voter suppression in Texas for the better part of a decade. I mean, really since the last redistricting in Texas that resulted in the kind of gerrymandering that we saw here that became sort of like infamous in the country, to the extent that it reduced Black and Latinx, growing Black and Latinx vote in the state. I'd been thinking of this like free and fair elections. A lot of people use that term when we're talking about, you know, like sort of the ideal, given all the rhetoric that we're hearing from Trump and the GOP right now about policing the vote and the myth of voter fraud and all that. You know, it's just when you look back in history, we've never really had free and fair elections. That's both like recent and all the way into the past. I mean, in the story that you reference, you know, I take it back to Reconstruction because I think that's just sort of like a formative, it's a really instructive period, because I think, you know, the tools of suppression, of course, were very, very different back then. You know, I detail some of the violence that was meted out against newly enfranchised Black people who were organized and were sending people to the state's constitutional convention and who were like sending some of the first Black lawmakers who had just escaped chattel slavery to the state legislature for the first time, and like the violence that was meted out against them to suppress that vote. But it was still about white power sort of fighting against a changing electorate. Today, the tools are different. They've evolved since then. You know, it's gone from white primaries to force, fraud, coercion, to Jim Crow laws, to voter IDs, to shutting down ballot drop-off sites. The tools are different, but there's still a through line as far as the motivation. So
let me stop you there, because they're not. Let me tell you why. Because I went back to the Reconstruction period where you talked about intimidation and you talked about lynching and you talked about the mobs and you talked about the threats. I'm going to what's happening in 2020. Can I talk about the people that are basically going to sort of be watching the voters, the people that are going to be coming with their weapons, the people that are being encouraged in basically by the president to intimidate? That is what they're being told to do. They're being told, you know, under the wink and nod of, we're going to just watch and make sure that there's no problem here. But you know exactly what they're going to target. They're not going to target districts where the Republicans are completely in control. They're going to target those other districts. And I don't know if you saw this picture the other day, but it was a picture from Miami, Florida. It was a polling place. Now, they've sent the police in to make sure that there's no problem. Here's what the policeman was doing inside the polling place. He had a mask on that said, Trump, no more BS. In the polling place, it was a cop. It was a cop. So as I go back to what you said with Reconstruction and the level of violence and intimidation, what is so scary to me is that for a while we may have cleaned it up and may have sort of white-collared it. We're going back to that Reconstruction phase, I feel.
No, I think you raise an important point. What has been done in the past and sort of like the road of suppression that led us to this point, which is sort of what I was talking about, the potential for some really ugly stuff on the eve of this election because of all like the rhetoric that this history has inflamed. Like, I don't divorce the rhetoric around policing the vote that has led to, yeah, the kinds of ugly things that you're talking about, from the years-long efforts in Texas to sort of drum up fears over quote-unquote illegals voting that leads to the attempted purge of a bunch of people off the voter rolls that are naturalized citizens. You're highlighting some very serious concerns that I think have only been amplified in recent months, and including here in Texas. I mean, there's an FBI, like a local FBI field office report that the Nation, there was like a, you know, a brief report on it. I think it was the day after the presidential debate where Trump was essentially, you know, saying stand back and stand by to like Western chauvinist, white power, whatever you want to call them, groups about policing the polls, that actually illustrated some of the legitimate threats that these groups might pose in the region.
Well, you know, you go back to like the purging. I want people to understand this is a pattern. It's been going on for so long, because when they're talking about purging, they're not talking about purging the Smiths and the Greens. Yeah. We have to let people understand the word purge means Hispanic. That's what the word purge means. So we use these generic terms that cover the assault on voting, okay? And what we have to realize is that ain't true. It isn't about a purge. It's a target. And who they conveniently purge are people that happen to have names of quote unquote Hispanic or whatever sort of origin. Then you have to find out that you're purged. Then you have to prove that you shouldn't be purged. Think of the effort that they're doing. And I think that's another way that we allow them to define the terms. And we need to sort of define back what the terms really mean.
I always say like the purge of naturalized citizen voters, because like that's what was happening here the most recent time, or at least that's what state, you know, leadership attempted to do. And he was a secretary of state at the time, but it was like, you know, a handpicked guy from the governor. It was clear that the governor was involved and sort of set that in motion, that there were some of the right wing forces that we're talking about were really like setting the drumbeat for that here in the state. But yeah, it was naturalized citizen voters. It was mostly Hispanic Latinx voters.
You have in your article that Texas has implemented one of the strictest voter ID laws in the country. You also mentioned in your article about you have the lowest voter turnout, if not the 50th, like 49th or 48th in the country.
Yeah, at least we used to. I mean, it's but yeah.
This is so exciting to me because I want people to know another way of looking at this is that they were successful at suppression. They were successful. What the last 2 years, I think, has been about is explaining that to the people who were suppressed. And you know what? If you're going to fight to free the slaves and you're going to fight for civil rights and you're going to fight for, you know, equal pay for equal work, how the frick can you not fight for your vote? And when you see the success that Texas has had, then you have to figure out a way of sort of challenging that. What I think is so interesting, and maybe you can explain it to me, there seems to be even a schism within the Republican Party. Because you have Governor Abbott extending early voting by a week. And then you have the chairman of the Texas Republican Party suing the governor for giving you an extra week during a pandemic. I mean, I'm looking at the GOP going, oh, my God, you're eating your young. What is going on here?
I think they've brought this in some ways to like an extreme that has like forced them into some pretty extreme positions as a party. Yes, it is remarkable to see a state party chair suing its own governor over expanding voter access while at the same time they're working to curtail it in other ways. It's just, I'm not sure how much I view that as a legitimate attempt or as like a CYA move in some ways. At the same time, I mean, you know, when I talk about this attempted purge of tens of thousands of naturalized citizen voters that happened not that long ago, with some of the same like right-wing groups, we used to call them Tea Party, Freedom Caucus, whatever they want to be called now, but that sort of iteration of conservatism has been drumming up the beat, you know, on, you know, alleged voter fraud. They're the ones that have also been asking for the governor to do things like limit and restrict ballot drop site locations, which he ultimately tried to do or is trying to still do right now. Right.
What is happening with the drop boxes? Because I know that he had said you can only have one drop box per county. And then in your article, I just want people to know that the difference in size between how many counties do you have in Texas?
It's like 250 some.
It's like some ridiculous
254, I believe.
But the size goes from like under 200 in a county to like millions in a county. Yeah. And one drop box per county. Oh, that sounds so fair to me. Until you see a county that basically has nobody. They're probably more rabbits than people. And again, that's where they use this language that sounds equal and language that sounds fair. And I think we have to sort of take all that language back and we have to shred it. Because not only is it not fair, but it is so obvious and pointed. Are we still at a place where they can only do one drop box? Or can we have a drop box on a tractor trailer that kind of goes around the county going, here you can drop now, you can drop, it's still one. I mean, does it say it has to be attached to the ground? I'm just trying to figure out, how do you do an end run around Governor Abbott?
But I think we've entered like mask off territory. I mean, that's what a lot of people that like litigate voting rights cases that are my sources or people that like organize around, you know, registering new voters. And they really feel like they're not even pretending at this point when it comes to like the party at one point trying to restrict how long the early voting window can be, an extra 6 days. And you can see the turnout in Texas in those 7 days. Like clearly it means something. On the other point, yeah, 200 people to a county versus, you know, Harris County, where Houston is one of the largest counties in the country, you know, four plus million people. It's obvious what the motivation is here. And Harris County in particular has been sort of like an instructive example of officials there. As the county has turned more blue, they've really tried to expand voting access actually in recent years. The clerk there has been like sort of unprecedented in the state and maybe in the country of trying to like expand safe voting options for people, including these like drive-through voting centers that we've seen recently that the state GOP also has sued to try to shutter. I think you're seeing, in one sense, what can be done at the county, at the local level. I mean, like a lot of the organizers and some of the ones that I cite in the story that we're talking about, they've been working pretty intensely at the county level, the county, because it's a patchwork of election systems, right? The Secretary of State can do things like this attempted voter purge that we're talking about of naturalized citizen voters or minority voters if they want. at the local level, there's still a lot that can be done to expand voting access, like expanding polling locations, you know, instead of cutting drive-through centers like what Harris County is doing. And what you're seeing the state do with state GOP leadership is try to cut down on that for no real legitimate reason. Oh, okay. I've listened in on some of these court hearings where the justification is laughable.
So I have a question for you. One of the concerns, and I actually just contacted one of the reporters in my state. In my state, we have same day registration. So you can actually register on election day. I don't believe that's true in Texas. Is that true?
No. Okay. No, it's not. It's a month.
Right. One of my concerns is that what the Republicans have done, which is really interesting, is that they haven't necessarily banked voters, but they've banked registration. And what we've seen is that the Republican Party has found a whole bunch of folks that have never been registered. Not people that have never voted or rarely voted. So at least they're in the system. These are people that have never really exercised the franchise. And you're looking around the country and you're seeing significant increases in Republican registrations of people who have no history of voting. Now, let me tell you why I'm sharing this with you. So I called my reporter. I ran for governor in 1992. What was 1992? It was the year of Ross Perot. Okay, let's remember this. So we have same day registration. About a week and a half before the election, Michael, I was in sort of a dead heat with the Republican. All right. Oh, my God, I could win in New Hampshire. And I was the first girl and I was like a liberal and all this other stuff. Well, I lose by 15 points. Now, how is that possible? Here's what we found out. The state with the second highest percentage of Ross Perot voters in the country was New Hampshire. All right. He got like 15% of the vote, a huge percentage. And what was so interesting about that Perot voter is that we'd never met them before. They had never voted before. They showed up on election day for the first time because they were ticked off. What was amazing is that not only did they go in and vote for Ross Perot with no history, a third of them voted for Perot and then left. They didn't give a crap. They were just sending a message, okay? And the other two thirds voted straight Republican because after all, this was a Republican state. I called this reporter and I said, that's what scares me. So you've got the Republicans who've been banking all these people to register. And I know in Texas, you don't identify as a Republican or a Democrat, but they know exactly what they're doing. In my state, you can vote same day. So everyone is looking at people who have records of voting, but there may be a lot of people out there that will surprise us on election day. And that's, I think, something that I'm not sure reporters are following. And I'm not sure people are sort of aware of. And I saw how it made a huge difference in what happened in 1992. It was a tiny variation on a theme, but they learned their lesson there. And that's what I see Republicans having done. Is anyone following these new registrations?
Like you said, in Texas, it's a little bit more complicated of a question because we don't know how that breaks down Democrat versus Republican, right? I mean, what I do know is that the most active sort of get out the vote efforts have been from progressive left-leaning groups here in recent years. I mean, if you're registering new voters in Texas, they're going to be Hispanic and Latinx voters. Not always, but a lot of them are going to be just because of the demographics in the state that are changing. I mean, when we talk about how like redistricting like suppressed the power of some of that vote, I mean, in the decade 2000 to 2010, it was something like 4.5 or so million new people in the state, and vast majority of that was Hispanic and then Black population. Those are the voters that are being registered here, kind of regardless of, you know, how they break down along party lines here in Texas. And I think in a lot across a lot of the Southwest, you've seen a lot of sort of trying to decipher what is the Hispanic vote, right? As if that's a monolith, which it's not. You know, you can say broad generalizations about like two out of three Hispanic voters are going to vote Democrat, but that might be changing based on the demonization of Hispanic people and the rise in hate crimes. And here in Texas, for instance, you had the shooting in El Paso, right, which was clearly derived from that sort of environment of hate. And so I think this might be a clarifying election in a lot of ways, actually, as to like who those new voters are and what ways they're leaning and what the politics of Trump has sort of like pushed them toward, maybe.
So I have a question. I never thought about this until recently. My stepdaughter lives in New Orleans, and we went down to do cleanup after Katrina. And one of the things we know about Katrina is that they moved a lot of people to Houston and that a lot of people never came back. Do you think that that also has sort of an influence on what's beginning to happen? I mean, it was, you know, what is it, 40,000, 50,000? But again, thousands of people stay. They bring their families with them, and ultimately, and so I see between what we said with a sort of growing Hispanic population, you also mentioned a growing Black population. And I think some of that actually can be seeded because of what happened with the hurricanes and Katrina and having so many people move into that arena as a result and never going back. it's, again, so interesting to me. Scott Braddock was always telling me that the best kind of deal you can ever get on a U-Haul is one that's leaving Texas, not one that's heading to Texas, and that you really understand how fast Texas is growing, and it's growing exponentially in a lot of ways. And again, those new voters don't necessarily have the same history and relationship with the GOP and the Democrats, and yet at the same time, they may be so offended by what they're seeing because the Republicans are so overt. You write in your article, while the methods of suppression have changed, the motivation today seems to be the same as it was during Reconstruction, a changing electorate that challenges white power.
Yeah, a lot of those new voters are young, too, is what we know, at least from previous elections, if the trends continue. And again, like, that's hard to even predict now, considering what we're seeing with early voting and what kind of election this is. I think predictions are real soft, right, as far as I'm... But still, you know, you've seen the young vote sort of really turn out in the past two elections, in part because of, increased organizing and money coming into the state just to do... Voter registration is hard here. The state makes it hard. And so... It's hard to get those voters to register and turn out, but groups are doing it. And you've seen, especially among young voters, you know, those are, again, majority Black and Latinx.
Last but not least, one of the concerns is that we have a lot of young voters on college campuses, but because of the pandemic, a lot of things are changing. A lot of campuses are going to just strictly online, which means they don't have to physically be there. Is there a concern that where normally you would have this sort of young people engagement, that because of the challenge of the pandemic on universities and colleges, that the historic, you know, there'll be all these students that are like registered in Texas, but now they may be going to school online, but they may not be in Texas. They may be in California. They may be in New Mexico. How is the state embracing those students? Are they considered Texas voters, or are they considered New Mexico and California voters? Because while they're registered to be at that college campus, because of the pandemic, they are not physically there.
Yeah, I mean, that depends on the individual, of course, where they're registered and how they've worked out their housing situation that's gonna depend. I do think what you're pointing out, that challenge is the reason why a lot of the groups that I'm talking about, like Move Texas is one that I've cited, which is, I think, pretty indicative of the kind of voter, like, you get out the vote, voter registration drive, like outreach campaigns that you've seen across states really since 2012, 2016, to try to make more battleground states, actually, have focused on young voters, and in particular around organizing around college campuses to make sure young voters know what their options are. So I know that there's been, like, the people I talk to, for instance, like, there's a whole lot of phone banking happening right now just to make sure people are, like, if they requested an absentee ballot, for instance, that they have it and they like send it in soon, right? Like, if they're going to use the mail, that they do it like now. Like,
you know, so I have a question. Do you have a rolling list of, so someone requested an absentee ballot. Do you know, can anyone access when that ballot actually arrives in order to be counted? So can you look at a list and say, okay, Bob Smith, he asked for a ballot. Yes, Bob Smith's ballot has arrived in Dallas, or Bob Smith's ballots have arrived in Houston. Is there a place to check? Or is that just random?
No, I mean, I think going to like the bifurcated sort of system, like, it's a patchwork system, so that's going to depend by county. But I do think just sort of like concern about your your absentee ballot, like in your mail-in ballot, with that, whether it gets counted, right? Like all that. I do think that highlights a greater issue that has been, again, it's another voting rights issue that was starting to be litigated in Texas already, that we're seeing decisions on the eve of an election, which is, who gets to challenge your absentee ballot? Who gets to decide whether it counts? And do you even get to know that they're like challenging it within the time window that you can actually do something about it?
We have an issue in my state. So the question was, historically, we thought that people who could do poll watching, you know, had to actually come from the community that they're poll watching. We just found out that anybody can poll watch. Oh, God. And on that note, the long tail of voter suppression, as the growing number of Black and Latinx voters threaten GOP stranglehold on power, attempts to limit safe voting options during the pandemic reveal a deeper sickness in Texas politics. But the good news is Donald Trump may, in fact, be the medication for that illness, because people are saying, you know, want me to vote? Watch me, honey bun. Anyway, thank you, Barajas. Thank you so much for joining us on the Texas Observer. I appreciate it.
Great being here. Thanks.
All right, ciao. All right, everyone, stick around. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and, of course, producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We'll be right back.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered.
From The Art of All Things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
Neanderthals are our closest extinct human relatives. Our well-known but often misunderstood ancestors lived between Europe and Asia up to 200,000 to 30,000 years ago. Neanderthals were shorter and stockier, with angled cheekbones, prominent brow ridges, and wide noses. Though sometimes thought of as barbarians, scientists have discovered that Neanderthals in fact used tools, buried their dead, and had control over fire. However many million years ago, battles and fistfights were commonplace, and research suggests that battles between humans could end up being pretty brutal. It makes sense, therefore, that our faces would have evolved in order to take a punch to the face. It also makes sense that the part of our body used for delivering the punch would have had to evolve as well. The study suggests that about the same time we started walking upright, our hands became shorter and square with opposable thumbs. This change has always been recognized as a means for tool manipulation, but recent studies suggest that evolution shaped our hands not for dexterity, but to form fists. Bipedalism allows us more chest room to breathe when we run, and slightly bigger brains suggest greater intelligence. These are unique traits to our ancestors, the Neanderthals and Homo erectus. It took about 100,000 years for the population to reach 1 billion people. It took about 133 years for it to reach its second billion, and 44 years after that to double again. Ecologists predict the world population will hit 8 billion people by 2025. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is The Attitude, the Thursday edition with producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Wired magazine put something out that was incredibly complicated, but so important. And I realized, you know what? I'm not going to run away from it because it's complicated. In fact, I want you to understand it, which is why I grabbed our guest. The title of the article is, What Does It Mean If a Vaccine Is Successful? Well, that's a great question. The pharma companies are all using different playbooks to test their COVID-19 shots. So the first team to claim victory may not have the best formula. Joining us right now from Wired is Adam Rogers. He writes about science and miscellaneous geekery things. And before coming to Wired, he was a Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT and a reporter for Newsweek. He is the author of the New York Times science bestseller, Proof, The Science of Booze. Well, as a state that sells liquor, I got to like share that with all my friends. So Adam, thank you so much for joining us. I said to you before we got on the air that I almost felt like I needed graph paper as I was reading this, because obviously we don't have a real understanding of vaccines. We don't really understand how the pharmaceutical industry works. They, of course, do. Why I wanted people to hear you and have you describe in your article was not only because it was so complicated, but I want to remind everyone, we're paying for this. Our tax dollars that are driving these pharmaceutical companies to really search for this vaccine. Obviously, everyone is in competition, and competition, we're told, is a good thing. But my fear about this competition, where there seems to be not exactly a standard of how we test these vaccines, makes me so frightened, knowing, one, we're paying for it. So what is the risk to them? It's less of a financial risk, but the risk to me is the health of my family, the health of my community, and the health of my country. So let me welcome you to the program and ask you to sort of begin to walk us through this whole story of vaccines and the U.S. government's relationship to vaccines, because I think this is important with an FDA and a CDC that right now I'm not quite sure I trust, given Donald Trump politicizing everything. So you've got that sort of at the backdrop as we're looking at something that is incredibly complicated and moving very quickly. Thank you for showing up.
Of course. Thank you for having me. And yeah, it is complicated, though I have to admit I feel a certain sense of failure and requiring a sophisticated and careful reader to need graph paper to follow a story. That suggests that I blew it. I want to start by saying good news first. Up until now, the fastest that any vaccine has ever been produced, from like, we need a vaccine, to here's the vaccine you can take, is 4 years for mumps. And that's built into the MMR vaccine now. And I want to be very clear that vaccines that are available today for an array of different diseases that threaten human beings are safe and they're effective.
Right.
Because for someone like me who, you know, I've written about vaccines and I've written about infectious disease, and I want to not discourage people from getting the vaccines that they need to keep themselves safe and to keep other people safe too, because vaccines are a real expression of community spirit. What's going on now with COVID-19 is a catastrophic pandemic that the federal government was to some extent unprepared for and to a great extent continues to fail to address. It seems like that's surprising for a journalist to say, but I think that's pretty factual to say that.
Let me just stop you there. Yesterday, we did an interview with ProPublica, and mm-hmm. we did an interview about the failure of the CDC. After doing that interview, you could sort of literally carry me off the floor because it was the most devastating article I've ever read. So I'm going from devastating to you. So my audience understands. They have a good backdrop as to what is happening. So this
terrific.
Is-
the government agency, and that ProPublic article about CDC was tremendous. The government agency that's responsible for giving authorizations to new drugs is the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. They're part of the Department of Health and Human Services. And those are departments that have likewise faced similar issues of politicization and other challenges being in the Trump administration. Okay, that's all backdrop of this. Now, one of the things that the government has done incredibly well in the last 10 months, sorry, I have the same problem with time that everyone does during the pandemic, is mount this unprecedented effort to have an accelerated development for a vaccine. The way that they did it is they gave a lot of money to a lot of pharmaceutical companies who are the ones with the most expertise and the most skill at developing vaccines. Some of them are better than others. If you get into the weeds, like who's done the best vaccines and who does them the most carefully and most ethically.
Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, yeah.
And in addition to this list of transnational pharmaceutical companies that all of us would recognize the names of from our local pharmacies, there's also a couple of new ones. There's a company called Moderna, and this is what you were alluding to before, that's using a technique for vaccinating that uses a genetic material called messenger RNA or mRNA, rather than some of the classic ways that people have made vaccines before. It's the kind of thing that seems like it should work, but no vaccine using mRNA has ever been approved. And Moderna as a company has never had a vaccine approved. They're a dark horse. It's terrible to make this sound like a horse race here. Right.
But let's also be honest here. We're at a place right now where being creative is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, right on.
I don't want to trash Moderna just because they've never had a history. I don't want to trash them because they've done something that's never been approved before. Frankly, this is such an unusual disease. We know that it has really negative complications. You can die from it. Maybe this is an opportunity for us to sort of explore new options. And let's be honest, we're also funding it. So the idea that someone is willing to experiment, assuming that we have the right kind of oversight on the result, I have no problem with that.
For sure. Absolutely right. And like from a scientific perspective, exciting. And from the perspective of trying to deal with a global pandemic, important, critical. But then what happens immediately is that you have a half dozen, whatever, companies all running their own trials, because running trials is expensive, and the government allowed them to run their own trials. I want to start there, even though that's not the top of the story, because I really do think that's important. There are a lot of different ways to test drugs like vaccines. What you want is you want these really big, randomized, controlled trials where the person administering the drug doesn't know if the test subject volunteer is getting the drug or a placebo. And you want to do that on tens of thousands of people because the effects may not, because not everybody gets infected with COVID-19 and the effects may be moderate. The number of people who get infected may be moderate, and you need to see a lot of events to know, like, did a large number of people who got the vaccine, when we look at the data at the end, did a large number of people who got the vaccine not get COVID-19, and a large number of people who got the placebo get COVID-19, right? So you do this trial.
Okay, can I ask a quick question? Does geography matter? So let me just say something. So for example, right now, the hotspots are the Dakotas. I'd like to test that vaccine on everyone in the Dakotas, you know, as opposed to Vermont or Maine. I'm wondering that as they look at who they actually get as volunteers, I would think geography also matters because some places seem to be more amenable to the disease because they haven't done the masking, they haven't done the social distancing. And other places, they seem to be like New York. They're trying to really, you know, walk the line. And I don't know enough about vaccines and volunteers, but do they look at the geography as they examine who's participating?
Geography is tremendously important. One of the ways that they try to deal with that is by having 30,000 volunteers, 44,000 volunteers. But that's a critical question because it's one of the challenges for all of the therapeutics, all the drugs and everything that's been tested so far. All pandemics are like this, but COVID-19 has been especially what one researcher described to me as spatiotemporally heterogeneous, which just means that it's very, very different in time and place. It moves, it has spikes and lumps. It doesn't spread out all over the country. And you can see this if you watch the curves from state to state or county to county. And that happens for a lot of different reasons that have to do with the dynamics of this specific disease and the dynamics of how people transmit diseases to each other. You get a lot of people, 44,000 people in one of these studies, because you want to make sure that you're including not just a geographically diverse population, but also an ethnically diverse population and a socioeconomically diverse population, because different people have different levels of exposure. What researchers have seen with this particular pandemic is that people of color and poor people are particularly vulnerable to the severe disease and to fatal reasons for a lot of reasons.
I read an article in early September that one of the concerns about the vaccines is that some of the vaccines are sort of more aimed at sort of wealthier, healthier people. So one of the concerns about the vaccine is that you want a vaccine that only works for people from different socioeconomic conditions, but a lot of people who come with different pre-existing conditions. You're not getting a healthy person and saying, okay, do they get COVID? You may be getting a person with diabetes and are they getting COVID? You may be getting someone with obesity and they're getting COVID. So again, as you're looking at this, you want to make sure that the vaccines don't work for a certain typecast and that the vaccines kind of work generically. And that is, as I was reading your article, how does the FDA set the standard for evaluating the vaccine?
Okay, so now we get to the meat of it. That was a long past as prologue, but yes. So now what happens is the FDA gives the rules to the drug companies and says, here's what we're going to be looking for from your results. What the FDA does not do, and nobody has really given a straight answer about this to any reporter, including to me, is why they didn't run the tests themselves and test the vaccines head to head against each other. Why will we not know, because this is one of the problems, which vaccine is better? So what the FDA said is, we want from you 50% efficacy, which is to say, like, it works half the time. And that's good for a vaccine. It's not perfect, but it's good, especially if you give it to hundreds of thousands of people, because what you're trying to do, remember, is stop the disease from spreading. You're trying to, let's say, balance the needs of public health of a population against the needs of every single individual person. And those sometimes are candidly in opposition. Mm-hmm. I think they're aligned, but that's a separate issue. Now, so they said 50% with a margin of error. So as low as 30% and as high as 70%. A broad
margin of error? That seems like a big margin. That's all you.
Big confidence interval. And then what they were initially unclear about is what they were going to ask for in terms of side effects and how long they wanted to study the population for having side effects. So what do side effects mean here? I got my flu shot this year, as everyone should. And I have to admit, this year, like, I felt it. Like, I felt muscle aches and fatigue and exhaustion for a day. I'm still really glad I got it. My whole family got it too. But side effects. Now, those are side effects that are we would call as mild. They're mild. It was not pleasant, but it lasted a day. And now I'm going to be helping my community and helping my family and myself. Severe side effects. Some vaccines that have been tested in the past have had very severe side effects, including Guillain-Barré syndrome, which was a really severe disease. There have been other consequences, right? And those are very real. And you have to compare those as well to people's fear that that vaccines could do things like put people on this autism spectrum, stuff which are not true. That doesn't happen. But people are scared of those things too. So you want to make sure that you're testing for the side effects. And initially, the FDA gave the vaccine companies some latitude to not wait for a long time after somebody got the vaccine. They weren't checking for up to 2 months. Now the FDA came back under pressure from the White House not to do this and said, you have to tell us about 2 months out after getting that shot of what kind of side effects there were. And this is related to two vaccine companies have paused their trials. Both Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca have paused because they had an adverse event of one person in the tens of thousands of people who got it. One person or a couple of people got sick, and they want to make sure that those people didn't get sick because they got the vaccine, that they would have gotten sick anyway. You can imagine in a population of 40,000 people, somebody's going to get sick. So have to check that.
Is there a standard of what we mean by side effects?
You lay it out, and the drug companies are asked to lay that out, or the FDA lays out for what those side
effects. My understanding is from your article, and maybe I misread it, was that sort of different companies are like interpreting side effects differently.
Yes, yeah. No, that's right too.
And I'm thinking, oh, that's good. That's like my A can mean something over in this class, but this A over here can mean something in that class. And so it feels like they're not talking to each other, and that you're not making an informed choice if everyone is defining a side effect differently. Well, that's huge.
As things stand right now, they are not talking to one another, and you definitely are not making an informed choice. I don't know how much of a problem that's going to be, but people are concerned. Researchers who look at vaccinology and virology are concerned. So here's what that means. Some drug companies were allowed to define some kinds of side effects as mild. Some companies, others were defining those side effects as moderate. So all of a sudden, you've got a different endpoint. Also, nobody would have known what those definitions were, because typically companies don't release to the public these massive, 100-page protocols for doing these studies. Under pressure, the companies finally released them because everyone was afraid. In politics, in science, and out in the world, civilians like you and me were worried that their protocols were not going to be up to snuff, that their protocols weren't going to do what they were supposed to do. Now, all of them have released those protocols, so you can do these kinds of evaluations. So the issue that they were all different, because they're not head-to-head, there's no head-to-head study, which is a thing you could do, but there's no head-to-head study. So you can't tell, you'll be able to tell which of them works, but not which of them works better than another, it'll be difficult.
Okay. Let me just say something. Again, we wrote the check. I want people to hear this. There's no freaking financial risk for these companies. They are doing this because they have the expertise and because they know that there's no financial downside to this. The only, frankly, financial downside is if they totally screw up, I'll never use that company again for anything. I mean, for aspirin. I mean, let's be honest here. So what I don't understand is that why didn't the FDA, why didn't the Health and Human Services say, if you are going to accept this challenge, this is what you are obligated to do. You're obligated to share information, because this isn't about Merck and it isn't about Pfizer and it isn't about Johnson & Johnson. It is about the health of the nation, which is why we are paying for it, And what so ticks me off is that as I read your article, there was more lack of definition. There was more, no ability to do competition. I felt like they just sort of threw money at them and said, come up with a vaccine, as if somehow throwing spaghetti at the wall is what they're doing. But we're talking about a vaccine that could be very different in who gets it. And my big fear from your article is that the first company that sort of comes up with a vaccine could really sort of douse other companies from moving forward, because they're thinking, well, what the hell? And it turns out they may have a better vaccine and we'll never freaking know.
That's a very real risk. And I think there's an intermediate sort of weirder risk, which is that multiple vaccines will get approved, which could happen. They'll have different efficacy levels, or one will be better for older people and one will be better for younger, and one will be better for people who live in the Dakotas or something. Right. No way to know yet what the differences will be. But how will you and I know which one we're getting? If I go get my shot at my local Walgreens or whatever, like, do I know which one they have? They got the one that they were able to buy, that they were able to get first. So it's not going to be like going to the store and seeing six vaccines on the shelf and looking at the label and saying, I want that one. You're going to go and get a shot.
Right. So I mentioned to you that yesterday we did this interview about the CDC, which is just unbelievable. And yet one of the things that was so unbelievable actually relates to our conversation about vaccines. And that is, this is a worldwide pandemic. Let me repeat. This is a worldwide pandemic. It turned out that the WHO actually came up with a test for COVID, and we screwed up. You know, you look at your face.
My face is collapsing because it's one of the great tragedies of the pandemic. Yes,
exactly. So as I'm saying that, I'm also looking at, my daughter lives in Shanghai. So we're talking about the vaccine in China with her a lot, because she's also pregnant. The Chinese are sprinting to find something as well. They've got smart scientists too, okay? They're not only talking about that, they're talking about sharing it with other Asian countries. This is our vaccine. We're not going to share it. We're not going to work with the WHO. We're not going to compare notes. I mean, on top of what you're telling me in your article at Wired.com about the fact that we're not having these companies within the United States that we're funding sort of talking to each other, we're not talking to the world. What the hell are we doing? And do you see this behavior that you've just completely brilliantly written about at Wired? Do you see this behavior continuing after the election? Or could a new administration require, since it is federally funded, that there is a higher standard and there is more communication between companies?
As a science journalist, I'm contractually required to seem really cynical until you scratch me even with the slightest little prick of a pin, and I become a naive schmuck who thinks that things will always get better. First of all, I think that the FDA has finally succeeded in holding the companies that are working on these vaccines to a higher standard than people feared. And the thing that makes me think that is that none of them are applying for an emergency use authorization before the election. And they've all basically said, because Pfizer was the first one that had a chance to do it, they've all said, we're not going to do it. So that means they're waiting to see what these side effects are.
I love you. But do you think this is FDA driven or is this politically driven? I think they're also realizing that if they did something now, that their vaccine will be so tainted because of Donald Trump and because of the way he's basically played politics with absolutely everything in our lives, that they are being smart. It has nothing to do with the FDA. It has to do with the fact that they're looking at the numbers and they're going, you know what? What good is it for us to come out a week early? Because if it's not trusted, then we just pissed away all our goodwill and all our trust in our vaccine. We'd rather have the trust over the long term. And so I hear what you're saying about the FDA, but sweetheart, the FDA has never been very good. I mean, they've always said, oh, you can do your own testing. Just show it to us just so we can look at it. I mean, they've never gone in and be sort of overtly involved in anything way of testing, not just vaccines. I hear what you're saying. If it's FDA driven, hallelujah. I think it's politically driven, but either way, I think that everyone is a winner as a result.
I think that's true. And I think as one drug watcher and researcher said to me, the FDA certainly these days exists as more of a kindly uncle than it does as an oversight agency giving suggestions for how you might want to proceed with these studies. And it also is this weird catawampus situation where the pharmaceutical, these giant transnational pharmaceutical companies of whom, you know, we should all have the same skepticism of any transnational corporation, right? They're basically an AI whose function it is to make money. And if they happen to do that by making a drug that works, that's great. Where they were the ones who like wrote op-eds to the FDA saying, don't do this badly, make sure to keep track of this, which is like, wait, did a drug company just say, don't improve my drug too quickly? That just never happens. And they did this time. So what I think is going to happen is that there is going to be an effective vaccine in whatever, you know, Tony Fauci and the rest of those folks will say, like Q2 or Q3 or something,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
Of next year, which will be great. And it will be safe and it will have a certain level of efficacy. Could there have been something better? is the possible tragedy that you look at.
And how do we ensure that if there is something better, that we tell these companies not to stop? I mean, since we're funding it, here's a dilemma. So do you tell them not to stop? Then who wants to be risking your life with an untested vaccine because it might be better, while you think you have a vaccine on the market that's already on the market that's sort of 50% okay? I feel like it's Sophie's choice. What do I do? Because you want to keep your family safe. You want to keep your country safe. This was approved. Why the hell would I wait in case it turns out that that other one, which might 5 months from now be better, but it turns out. So here's my question. Could you get two?
Yeah.
Could you get two vaccines? I'll take the 50% one. I'll take the 90% one.
Yeah, especially if they work differently. Now, I mean, is there a chance that there's going to be some kind of weird cross-reactivity or something? I mean, maybe, but that's minimal. And hopefully they can start to test that too. Like, you can start to figure that out.
Right.
There's no like baseline reason that you wouldn't be able to go get another one when one that nominally.
Wouldn't it make sense? So it's not like it's a parallel track, but the idea is, all right, you get the first one done. Okay, that's good. And then tell them, keep testing. And as they're testing, because you know that not everyone's going to get the vaccine right away anyway. It's going to take a long time to roll the sucker out. So you might as well be involved in one of those trials as you're waiting for yours. And if it turns out that that one's better, I mean, I just want people to think creatively. I don't want us all to sort of, you know, jump onto one ship and assuming that that ship works when it's going down. And that if the government is funding it, there is an opportunity for us to constantly look at other vaccines and improve the result, not just assume that the first one out of the box is the one that will be the one that we have to be stuck with.
And there will be more and more information as they start coming out. Part of the thing that Operation Warp Speed did was what they de-risked and what they did for speed was as soon as you had a candidate, they started manufacturing it. So that there were supposed to be, you know, 100 million doses, so that there are going to be some that it's not like you're going to throw them away. When you like, one will come out, it will hit, it will get approval, it will be seen as safe because the statistics will work, and that will be the one that starts to go to, not clear who gets it first, right? Is it older people? Is it frontline healthcare workers? People in essential risk, in essential jobs? Some decision's going to have to be made because there's not enough for everybody, and just the logistics make it clear, as my colleagues, Mary McKenna and others, have written so ably about.
I want to talk to you every week. So as I'm listening to you, I have one question. So let's say it's 50% successful, or maybe 45 or 30, since 30 is still okay. So I get the vaccine. How long do I have to wait before I know that it's successful? And what if I'm in the 70% where it's unsuccessful? How do you behave after a vaccine? How do you behave? Do you still mask up? Do you still socially distance? Do you still work online? Because we are talking about such an incredible range of success with this vaccine, I'm trying to figure out, so what guidance am I getting? Am I going to be living with a mask for the rest of my life?
Right. Guidance has been terrible. But I think that society has been rewritten for quite a while going forward. I think masks in public places are going to be something that we should now be used to, as they are used to in many other places around the world. It's never been a characteristic.
I landed in Shanghai in 2013 in December, the worst air pollution in world history. They had to divert the plane to Beijing because they couldn't land. Let me just tell you, you walk around China, everyone has masks. You walk into a home of a Chinese person, my daughter lives in Shanghai, she has different kinds of masks based on the level of pollution. They still have families, they still have children, they still go out to restaurants. So it hasn't compromised their life, but it is now part of their attire. And I think what's interesting is between climate change and what's happening with the fires in California and Oregon and Washington, that's going to be part of their lives. So, you know, welcome to the world of the West Coast. And as a result of the pandemic, that's also maybe part of our future, because this isn't going to be the only pandemic that we're going to be addressing. And maybe the way to keep us safe, and it may ultimately keep us safe from the regular flu that you just got a shot for, and I just got a shot. This was a fabulous interview. You are a phenomenal writer at Wired. They are so lucky to have you, Adam Rogers.
Oh, thank you.
Title of his piece: What Does It Mean If a Vaccine Is Successful? The pharma companies are all using different playbooks to test their COVID-19 shots. So the first team to claim victory may not have the best formula. Please, I'm going to invite you back again. You have another piece up at Wired. I want my audience to stay on top of this. I want them to be informed. I want them to stay engaged. I don't want them to say no to something right away because they're afraid of it, but I want them to understand with an informed yes. And that's exactly what you've been able to do with this story about vaccines. So Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
It is my pleasure. I'm delighted to do it.
All right, ciao. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao, everyone. You bet.